are listening to the Mythmaker Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Joseph Campbell Foundation podcast, Pathways with Joseph Campbell. I'm your host, Bradley Olson. On this podcast, we share archived audio lectures given by Joseph Campbell over the course of his teaching and lecturing career. On this episode of Pathways, we will be listening to a 1966 lecture that Campbell gave 30 miles or so north of New York City in Rye, New York, at the Wainwright House. The Wainwright House itself has an interesting history. The house was completed in 1931 by J. Mayhew Wainwright, who was a United States Congressman, Assistant Secretary of War, and a highly decorated World War I veteran. The Wainwrights are an old and influential family in New York. In fact, Wainwright's mother was a direct descendant of Peter Stuyvesant, who was the last Dutch governor of New York in the mid-1600s. During World War I, Wainwright was a lieutenant colonel headquartered in an 18th-century French chateau, the design of which had a great impact upon him. He subsequently modeled Wainwright House on that chateau. In 1951, Wainwright's daughter established Wainwright House Incorporated, which is today the oldest nonprofit, non-sectarian, holistic learning center in the country. It might be useful to say a few words about what we mean when we speak of mystical experiences. When we speak of a mystical experience, there are many orders and types. But in contemporary life, we generally understand mysticism to mean something like the path to becoming one with the divine or the absolute, experiencing altered states of consciousness which may frequently involve some kind of transcendent spiritual awareness, and a sense that the bounded self is transcended and hidden truths are revealed. Ultimately, the mystical experience is to be regarded not as an end or a goal in itself, but rather as an aid to the larger goal of personal transformation. Mysticism is a word which is hard to define because it is understood in many different ways. One might, for example, find in mysticism some essentialist truth, that there's an unseen, ineffable reality underlying and informing the material reality in which we go about our daily lives. Or one might see mysticism as a defensive religious structure designed to protect religious feelings and sentiments from scientific inquiry and other reductionistic explanations, keeping issues of politics, social ethics, and modernity at bay. Others may use the word mysticism to describe their own direct experience of the divine, while others still may use the word in a pejorative manner to describe some sort of apostasy or heresy. You can see, I think, the polymorphism of the word mystical and the immense scale of the discussion it seems to demand. Professor Campbell begins this lecture by indicating that he will offer a scholarly perspective of mystical experience, which is to say, a more detached and objective exploration of the symbols of mystical experience than that of, say, a member of a particular mystical sect might offer. Campbell points out that for him, religion and mythology are one and the same, and throughout this lecture one starts to understand that mystical experiences and their symbols are mediated by various pre-existing frames of reference, or they are retrospectively identified and understood by the attribution of religious concepts and meaning. In other words, mystical experiences are fully conditioned by the ideas, rites, and symbols from the religious and cultural traditions with which the mystics themselves are familiar. And yet, in his familiar and engaging dialectical way, Professor Campbell also touches on a more widely held understanding of mysticism, which is sometimes referred to as the perennial philosophy, that insists that mystical experiences point to a single, ineffable, and unfathomable universal transcendent reality. This is much the same approach as William James employed in his classic text, The Varieties of Religious Experience. So please enjoy Joseph Campbell's 1966 Wainwright House lecture on the symbolism of mystical experience, And immediately after his talk, I'll be back with some final remarks and talk about some of the important and interesting ideas from the lecture. And now, Joseph Campbell.
Now, what I propose to do is deal with the problem of mysticism in a big, broad way, from the point of view of a scholar, not a mystic, let me say, and to contrast, particularly, the attitudes of the East and the West as they come down through the main lines of the traditions. Now, in the first place, I think one should begin by considering the functions of a mythological or religious, for me, the two words are synonymous, mythological tradition. The first function of a tradition, a great culture-building tradition, is to awake and maintain in the spirit of the individual a sense of awe and gratitude before what remains the mystery of the universe and the mystery of being. This is the first function of all religions and mythological traditions. The second function, normally, is to present a total image of the cosmos, what we call a cosmological image, a cosmology, which will be a vehicle of this experience of awe and mystery. Now, in a purely empirical scientific approach to cosmology, physics, astronomy, and so forth, this sense of awe is cut off. That's to say, the scientist is not properly, professionally at any rate, interested in evoking this. But the image that the scientist presents is susceptible to this kind of experience. All you have to do is look through a telescope. All you have to do is think of the millions and millions of galaxies that have been identified to realize that there's an opportunity for you to experience an awe and a sense of the mystery of the cosmos that surpasses anything that the little Babylonian image in the first book of Genesis can give you. The scientific image, therefore, is susceptible to this, but it is not the business of the scientist to present the sense of mystery. What he's telling you is what the causal relationships are in this veil of being that time and space presents to us. However, the mystery is there. So that a scientific cosmology is just as pertinent a vehicle for this sense of the mystery of being as the old cosmologies were, except that the scientist is not concerned to render that aspect of it. That, you might say, is the business either of yourself or of whoever is enabling you to find the centers of your life and being. The third function of a traditional mythology or cosmology is to validate and maintain a social order. Now, traditionally, the social order is regarded as a part of the cosmic order. It is of the same nature and character and a part of it, since society is itself part of the cosmos. Each man's place in this order is indicated, and he lives not in terms of his own personal wishes and desires, but in terms of his understanding of his placement in this cosmic order, so that he participates in the great cosmos just as the sun does, and the animals do, and the trees do. As a member of this society, he is part of the cosmic order. First, a sense of awe before the mystery of being. Second, a cosmology, a cosmic image which will carry that sense of awe. Third, a social image which will be related somehow to the cosmic image. And fourth, a harmonization of the individual psyche. The first function is the properly religious one. This is the evocation of awe. The second we assign now to physics, astronomy, and the physical and biological sciences. The third is the problem of sociology and the police department and the gentlemen in Washington and so forth, who arrange for us a society and maintain a society that will enable us to live according to the aims and ends that we conceive to be proper for a human existence. And the fourth is the field of psychology. Now, two of these functions greatly change during the centuries, the second and third, to wit. As the scientific exploration of nature carries us further and further into this vast realm of mystery, the concept of the cosmos changes. Along with this also, and particularly since the invention of the power-driven machine at the end of the 18th and beginning of the 19th century, the structure of the society also has changed, so that the sociological image has greatly varied. But there are two aspects of this that remain pretty constant. One, awe before the mystery, and the other, this human organism, which has not changed, essentially, at least since the emergence of Homo sapiens about 30 or 40,000 years ago, the time of the Ordination Caves. There are two constant factors, then. No matter how far you push the scientific study of the cosmos, that realm of mystery remains. Constant number one, then, is this mystery. Constant number two is the human organism itself, which has certain requirements and certain characteristics that have to be dealt with in every society. Changing in the course of history, and greatly changing, are the second and third, the cosmology and the sociological aspects. Now, let me say a word about the functions of religion, traditional religions, in relation to the constant of the human psyche. First characteristic of the human being in the great spectrum of life is that of all animals, it matures the most slowly. There is a period of some 12 to 20 years when the human being, but particularly the first 12 or 14, the human being is dependent. And a psychology of dependency becomes established in that period. When something happens, the child turns to the parent. Actually, the child can hardly move for several years, hardly take care of itself at all. It falls down on its little face and so forth. Mother's there to pick it up again. No other animal has this long, long period of dependency. And then suddenly, it has to become self-responsible. It has to become a responsible character. Now, this crisis of changing the whole psychological structure from attitudes of dependency and turning to someone else to an attitude of being the one who is responsible for the situation, this requires a radical transformation of all of the reflexes. And this is the function of the puberty rites, initiation rites of primitive societies. Now, in our own society, we're neglecting this in our education. There's no doubt about it. Our educational institutions have become officially institutions for dispensing information. These are two quite different things. One, the information education, that is to say, filling heads with information. And the other, the leading of the psyche into a new position. And since, in our culture, to be a PhD, you're dependent until you're about 30 years old. We have an infantile situation drummed in, and then we wonder why. The psychoanalyst is such a busy man. All the psychoanalyst is concerned to do, literally, is to change dependency responses into responsibility responses. A person who, as an adult, suddenly finds himself feeling with nobody to help me, I'm and in a responsible position, is seeking dependency or acting in terms of some invisible person up there who says, "Oh ho ho, you must behave so and so." This person is fit for the couch. And what he has to do is be led back to his infantile commitments and have them somehow broken along the line. Well, now, when you read or attend, as I had the privilege of doing once, an initiation ceremony in a relatively primitive society, what those youngsters undergo is something. Their bodies are changed. They don't have a youngster's body anymore, even. The scarifications and other things that happen to them. They're turned into little adults. They're terrified. Any kid that can go through this has been changed, psychologically changed. And the very interesting thing is these two dominant images, father image and mother image, are turned into images which are taken in, so that the individual is no longer subject to the father, but is himself in that role. And there are little rites where the boy finds himself in that role. Now, there are a couple of very interesting ones. Let me just name a couple of examples. A little fellow finds himself facing a demon. This demon has been the bugaboo of his childhood. If you're not good, so-and-so will get you. The demon, of course, is Uncle Rain in the Face, all made up. At the ceremony, the boy is challenged by the demon and has to come out and give battle with him. Now, if you can imagine this, he actually thinks this is it. And he grapples, and he is allowed to win. The mask is taken off. It's Uncle Rain in the Face. This person whom he has conquered will be in relationship to the young woman whom he is to marry and so forth. So there are all kind of that kind of thing in here too. But he suddenly finds that the whole bugaboo structure, the whole spirit structure in which he has been raised, is a masquerade. Now, the next act is not that of, oh, gee, it's just a mask. Not at all. The mask is put down on the shrine and to be revered. Because that is a role. That mask represents a power system. And he assumes the mask. And now, look what has happened. He has gotten outside of the social horizon and is himself a supporter of it, and a giver of it, and a representative of it. Think what this would be in our culture. The only thing I can think of is Santa Claus, where, as a child, you see Santa Claus. As daddy, you are Santa Claus. And we realize that Santa Claus plays a role. He represents something about a relationship of children to parents, of older generation to younger generation, of benevolence and warmth and gratitude and all, and one enacts that role. Now, you'd have to push this farther to get to where the primitive world goes. You'd have to take images that we regard as divine, which are only masks, for a mystery that surpasses our comprehension. Now, the next great problem in the human system is that of all animals, we face the longest old age. Not only do we have this period of declining powers, but we also know that the door that we're going through next is death. No other animal faces death consciously. So the same mythology that has to carry the child from dependency to responsibility has to take care of him when his ability to function in the responsible role begins to decline. He can't do it. He's getting tired. Things are breaking. The old car is busting up. What next? Now, just as, again, in our society, the child tends to be delayed, so also we tend to try to hang on to our noonday, to when the descent begins, to hang on to our golf score. This creates a resistance. I'm speaking in very gross terms. I'm not saying that everyone has this, but this is the tendency in our structure. When does this little thing begin? Well, I heard an account some years ago that remains in my mind to enable us to identify this moment, in a man's life at any rate. Before this moment, his midlife moment, his principal concerns are, and properly are, wine, women, and song. And after that, it's Metrical, the same old gal, and sing along with Mitch. Now, when we have this crisis behind us, the whole symbol system has changed. The youth, for youth, it's life that's the frightening and challenging thing. And then later on, it's this business of going properly out of the picture. You know what the religions do normally. They put Papa and Mama over here, going back to great old, as Blake called him, Novo Daddy, who's up in the sky, and the childhood, the second childhood pattern is carried on, and we're going back to Mother and Daddy again. That's all right if it carries people on. As they say, it's pedagogically okay. But there must be a richer, deeper, stronger way to move into maturity than this one. Now, on the popular level, all the religions have to handle these crises. These are called the rites of passage, the passing of the inevitable thresholds of life. Wonderful rituals, sometimes very beautiful. Birth, the parent now recognizes the child and its duties toward the child. Adolescence, marriage. Then rituals of installation, when the person is assuming a social role. A judge must judge in terms of justice, not of his own prejudices or advantages. Ruler must rule, clergyman must teach. And then come these rites of moving into the older brackets. But there's another level of the religions. And this has to do with the person who begins rather early in life to have a sense of something, as old words were said, far more deeper infused. Some sense. This is the mystical. These are the things I would call simply psychological. They have to do with carrying this strange animal through this strange course. We come now to the mystical field. This properly is the field of religion. It has to do not only with the awe before being, but integrating yourself somehow, basically, with that. Now, it's that that I want to talk about. If we regard the whole great field of the higher cultures, I'm not going to speak about the primitive now, unless you want it later on, but I want to speak of the high cultures of the world, those of the great civilizations. One can divide the high cultures of the Eurasian world into two great orders, those west of Persia and those east of Persia. Eastward of Iran, Persia, there are two great culture centers, two great creative culture centers. They are India and Far East. Now, both of these are relatively cut off from intercourse with other parts of the world. India, I'm speaking of this before the arrival of the great airplanes and so forth, nothing's cut off now. But traditionally, there was India with the sea around it and very few harbors, by the way. And the great Himalayas in the north, and only a very thin trickle of new influences could come in. And the civilization, that is the main civilization of India, enters India in the early Bronze Age period, about 2500 BC, and anything that comes in later becomes absorbed and assimilated to that. So you have a very conservative situation here. Similarly, China, with the great deserts, remains relatively isolated. And the basic civilization of China arrives with the Shang Dynasty, 1523 BC, and has remained basically what it was then, with new influences, but the established pattern. Both of these civilizations represent the old Bronze Age way of thinking, and I'm going to speak about that in a minute. Now, westward of Iran, there are two great creative culture centers also. One is the Near East. That is the area where high civilizations first developed and from which they were diffused. And the other is Europe. That is the great place of the Paleolithic hunt, the great caves of Lascaux, Pechmel, Tuc d'Albert, and so forth, 30,000 BC, with a history of between 20 and 30,000 years of continuity there. The great hunt, the individual, the vigorous, individualistic attitude in contrast to the social group of the Near East. The Near East and Europe, with the wonderful Mediterranean between, have been in intercourse and conflict for centuries. There is a great activity back and forth. These other two remain reposed out here in the realm of the Old Bronze Age. Now, with respect to the mystical tradition, one can divide, as I've said, the world into these two great groups, India and China, Japan, the Near East, and Europe. I want to speak of the Eastern Way first. These two cultures share very intimately the Old Bronze Age attitude. It is this: the ultimate mystery, the ultimate truth and being of the world is absolutely beyond all naming, all imaging, all conceptualizing. Absolutely transcends discussion. Therefore, to attribute qualities to that mystery is to fall short of it. We ask, is God just, merciful, good? These are human traits which are projected. From this standpoint, those you are anthropomorphizing there. That's anthropomorphic. That's just as, what can I say, inappropriate as picturing an old man with a beard sitting on a cloud. So that the whole concept of the divine as person, with personality, and with personal traits is absolutely alien to that point of view. What you have is a sense of absolutely impersonal, inconceivable power. This power is called Brahman, this power is called Shakti, this power is called Tao. There are no end of names for it. But what it is just that thing that's scaring everybody now, what happens when the atom explodes. Just power. This doesn't care about you at all. But the next part of this story is that that mystery which transcends all conceptualization is your mystery. It's the mystery of your being, because you are. And that being is the same mystery as the being of the universe. This object has an existence. It is exactly as mysterious as the existence of the universe itself. It's the same mystery right here. So you can take anything, stick, stone, dog, put a ring around it and regard it not as anything you can name, but as an absolutely transcendent mystery. And it becomes an object worthy of your contemplation and something that can fill you with the sense of your own mystery. Now, the great word here is the word that occurs in the Chandogya Upanishad, Tattvam Asi. Thou art that. You are, in your are-ness, your beingness, that very mystery that you are concerned to worship, adore, and find marvelous. Alan Watts has just translated this in the way that really hits, and it's a perfect translation. You're it. Tat, tvam, asi. Tat means that, tvam is you, asi, are. You're it. Now, what then is the function of the religions in the Orient, of the cosmic image in the Orient, of the society in the Orient? It is to give you that experience. Now, I call this the mysticism of identity, to have a realization, not simply the thought, oh, this is the easiest thing in the world to think, I'm it, but to have an experience of that, not on the level of you as you can think of yourself, but on the level of you as you can't think of yourself. Because if it's you as you think of yourself, that's not it. This is what Zen's all about. This is what Buddhism's all about. This is what the whole show is all about. East of Iran. You go into some of these beautiful temples. There's the image of Amida Buddha. You see people before it, hitting a little dragon mouth, singing, you know, Namu Amida Butsu, Namu Amida Butsu, and you think, oh my God, what? Well, what is going on there? The person is trying to erase his thought about himself. The function of what's called japa in Sanskrit just repetitive praying is to dull the thinking faculty, because the thinking faculty is always naming things and identifying things, and what you're trying to get to is an experience of what can't be named or identified. And then one minute, somehow, something happens. The little acts of worship with that image, it doesn't matter whether the Buddha ever lived. No one cares. Because that's not what one's talking about. A man who lived somewhere one time and did something. That image is an image out there of what's in here. And what you're worshiping is that aspect of yourself which you can't get at. The function of art, the function of right, the function of society is to help you to get at it by bouncing it off. What Shakespeare says when he speaks of art, art holds the mirror up to nature, works here. Only it's not the nature that you would see without the artwork. It's a kind of X-ray view, a view in depth. So you can say, you are that, you're it. You can say, you're not it at all. Because the you that you're thinking about when you usually think you, that's no more what you're trying to get at than the flicker on a wave is the sun. So you're it and you're not it. We have there a double statement. You are and you're not. Depends on what aspect of yourself you're managing to get in touch with. And the goal of these things is to erase ego, to erase ego, to erase ego. This is what the kid's getting now with LSD. That's what it's all about. Knocking out the mind so that an experience can come through. Before LSD came along, I had a very interesting conversation with a group of psychiatrists, psychoanalysts, about Zen. Why Zen? I mean, this became quite a vogue before the LSD. Well, the point of Zen is this. We are so conceptualized in our education that we always name things and think of things. Even when people fall in love, they think, now, is this the kind you marry on? Is this the kind, how far do you go with this? And what my mother's saying, all that. Nobody's having an experience. Everybody, it's just classifying things. And after you've classified everything in terms of what people have said, in terms of what the world has told you all this is about, of course, what you're experiencing has never been experienced before because you are a quite different organism from any other. The number of separate cells that are involved is far more different than one car and another. You're having experiences on your own, and yet you're trying to classify it in terms of what people tell you to think. What the Zen thing does is cancel the mind so that you have experience. People have a sense of rootlessness because they've never experienced anything. They've always classified everything. All you become is a kind of filing cabinet. And this impact is what people are trying to get at. And our education has nothing to do with it. A writing course, creative course. You read somebody else's short stories, and then you try to see what's being sold this year, and then you try to think your thoughts in that form, and that's that. The whole tendency is to kill this spontaneity of experience and statement. And with your mind trained always in what we call the critical aspect, the lyric of expression is cut off before it comes. You think, oh, look at all these great writers and they're getting these terrible reviews. What could I do? And when you put your little nose out, you think, it's no good, and you cut it off. Then you cut it off some more and you think, I can't do it. And that's the young student and the old student and the person with what's called writer's block. Well, now to shift to the West. Our so-called religions come, one and all, from the Levant, from the Near East, not Europe. Zoroastrianism, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. These are the great so-called religions of the world. In all of these, God made the world, and they are not the same. There is an ontological, an essential distinction in our tradition between creator and creature. You cannot say, I am that. That is the prime heresy. Now, this leads to a totally different psychology and religious structure. The goal of our religions is not to bring about a sense of identity with the transcendent. Goal is to bring about a relationship between man and God, who are not the same. This is fundamental. The word immanent, which I used to describe this experience that it's right here and that you're it, has become very fashionable in religious circles today. The Christian community feels that the Indians have stolen a march or something by having this immanence, so that we hear talk of immanence now in our own religious circles. But press for the definition, and I have been concerned to do this when I get into these discussions, and it is not immanence. It's always relationship. One can say God is omnipresent. That's not the same as immanent. You cannot worship a stick and stone. Of course, when you are worshiping a stick and stone, what you're really worshiping is your own being bouncing off that. You're it. You can't say that. That's what Christ said, and he was crucified. That's what Halaj said, and he was crucified. That's the thing that cannot be said in these traditions. And when you have two entities like that, man and God, there comes a question, finally, of your ultimate loyalty. Is it to man or is it to God when it comes really to a squeeze? The typical attitude of the Levant, of the Near East from which our religions come, is submission of human judgment to what is conceived to be God. The typical attitude of the European, and I'm speaking of the pagan European, the Greek, the Roman, the German, and the Celt, is to stand for man. For example, let's take the book of Job. I'm just going to speak of Yahweh or God as though he were a God. Please excuse, but that's the way, the only way to compare two systems. In that book, God treats Job outrageously. There is no human justification for what went on there. He had a bet with his pal, the devil, and he said, I bet I can do anything to this good, good man who loves me, and he will not squeak. The devil says, I bet. So then it starts. As Gilbert Murray said in one of his discussions of this matter, it's as though you took your pet dog and did everything you could to him to see how far you could go before he'd bite you. And Job was a real good dog. He did not bite. But when his so-called comforters arrived and said, you must have been a bad man, because that's the traditional way of interpreting unfortunate experiences, you've been bad and you're being punished, Job said, I haven't been a bad man. And he was right. He hadn't been. The reason he was being given this deal was that he had not been bad. So God now, challenged to this extent, reveals himself. And what does he say? Does he say, Job, I had a bet with this fellow. That's what he said. Did he try to justify himself in any roundabout way? Nothing of the kind. He says, are you big? Can you fill the nose of Leviathan with harpoons? That's what he says. He said, I did. Try it. Who are you to criticize what I do? And Job said, I abdicate my human judgment. I'm ashamed. That is the religious attitude. That's the proper religious attitude. That's the attitude you get most enormously expressed in Islam, where God's will is beyond justice, beyond goodness, beyond any concept you can have. And if you are a devotee of God, you've got to take anything and don't try to rationalize it. That is that mysticism. It's a totally different one from the Indian that I've been talking about. But what would a Greek Would a Greek have got down and groveled like that? Well, we have an example. Prometheus stuck to a rock by Zeus. Zeus was big. Zeus could fill Leviathan's nose with harpoons. And he sent a little embassy to Prometheus. And the embassy said, if you will apologize for that trick you played on Zeus, he will let you go. And the words as Aeschylus gives them is these. I despise him. I care less than nothing for Zeus. Let him do as he likes. And you know what happened to the Greek gods. They represented the same power that Yahweh represents, the power of the universe, the power of the mystery against the little mind of man. And those deities, they diminished. Under the light of human values, they're like wolves, those gods. Sure, you're careful, but you don't say, I submit my judgments to your judgments. This is the problem of humanism versus the religious theological position of the Orient, of the Near East. And these two, as I've said, are in collision in our world. The humanistic position and Sunday morning position. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, we're humanists. For half an hour on Sunday, go through a few attitudes toward Yahweh, and Monday we're on the psychoanalyst couch. We wonder what's the matter. Now there's another problem today in our tradition. As I've said, according to this view, the divine is not within yourself. When you turn within, what you do not find is the divine. What you find is a human soul. And that human soul may or may not be in proper relationship to its God. The great word of the biblical tradition is, nature is corrupt. The fall, whether you designate it as original sin or not, the whole concept of sin is involved here. That you have somehow a responsibility to God to obey some kind of law that you conceive him to have rendered. And of course you can't obey them. As St. Paul says, the law is something you can't obey, and so this awful sense of guilt comes. Well, how do you get related to God? You become related through an institution. I call the first mythic dissociation. You have been dissociated within yourself from the divine principle. Now you become associated with the divine through a social institution, through identifying yourself with a social institution. I'm speaking about the traditional religions. This we can call social identification. You are a member of. Consider the two main ones for our concern. The Orthodox Hebrew tradition, God has a covenant with a people. That's a relationship. God and a people have an arrangement. It does not touch other people. It is not something that you find by looking at the sky. We know about it only because it comes down in that book. This is the tradition of a special revelation, in contrast to the cosmic revelation I was talking about before. Our religions are pinned, and they are, traditionally, to the concept of a special revelation to a special people, which constitutes an arrangement between God and that people. Next, we come to the Christian tradition. Christ, that's the center here. True God and true man. This is regarded as a mystery, because these are two different things. It's no mystery at all in the Orient. Say that about this, about any of us. You're it. What I'm trying to do is indicate three totally contrasting positions with respect to this awesome mystery of the conscious mind and what we think of ourselves as, and this mystery. Are you it? If so, how do you come to experience that aspect of yourself? Are you not it? Well then, how do you get in relationship to it? You get in relationship to it by submitting to a certain social group which has claims, or do you do it, as the Greek does, through finding what the highest faculty in the realm of nature is? It's your own mind, your own reason. Not thunderstorms, not the wolves and bees, but the human mind and feeling. These are quite different approaches. Now comes the next awful thing. Our tradition is committed to these social groups and their claims. The biblical claim, the church's claim, the claims about Christ. And in the light of modern historical and scientific research, those claims are brought into question. That is to say, we have been emptied of our sense of our own divinity. We have been committed to a social organization which sets up a claim for itself. And now that claim is in question, to say the least. So now we have what is called alienation. People feel cut off. The wasteland situation. And I think personally that this is evident, very evident, in the lives of our youngsters, in the lives of our religious communities. But there's a quest, and it's going on very strongly. And one of the very interesting things is the extremely powerful influence today of these words that are coming to us from the Orient, where the idea of the divine is somehow revealed all about and within ourselves. Now this is it's coming to us from the Orient, but it's in our tradition. It is that aspect of our tradition which the official tradition has always regarded as heretical. All you have to do is begin reading the heretics and you find it again. I've had this experience of 30 years of absorption in Hinduism and Buddhism, and then returning to some of the school books that I had worked on in college and in graduate work. They're the same ideas. They're put forward in words that have, however, become contaminated with this other tradition in our culture. The word God for us represents this personality somehow. And not only just the concept of personality, but a specific one. Now we have these young theologians repeating Nietzsche's word, God is dead. But what does that mean? That means that the God that you've been reading about and that comes into your mind when the word comes along, no longer can be supported. He's not supported in your experience. One doesn't experience that. Is not supported by the cosmos. How could that silly Babylonian cosmos be put forward seriously today? That you get, you know, heaven above, earth, waters beneath, and then all these things. Nobody works on that basis. Now, this awful thing of, for social reasons, because you're scared to be alone or something, having to make believe you have a belief that you don't have. This creates a hideous state in the psyche. And it leads, furthermore, to all kinds of things. Political life, where people represent things they don't believe, because they don't know what they do believe, what they do believe nobody would accept, but everybody's waiting to hear it anyhow. There's a strange system of dissociation between action and the validity of the human being. The first aim of the mystical experience is to become valid. To find centers in yourself that are spontaneous. Not to name them, not to call them Brahman, Shakti, Yahweh, soul, or what, but to have something happen in there. That's the beginning of the story, it seems to me. And anything that'll bring that about is to be fostered, but not to fake it. That's the problem of art. Function of art, originally, was to present forms that would awaken the sense of that form of forms within yourself. The jump that's coming out. And then the fashion, yes, if you're sophisticated, you like this year, and you like something else the next year, and something so on and so forth. Everything goes out of fashion, comes into fashion again. Even that realm of the valid expression of an experience has been somehow contaminated by this fake situation. So Point one that I would like to make in moving toward the end of this discussion, this talk. In the mystical realm, the first problem is spontaneity. The validity of one's own experience against authority. The authority is there only as a launch, something to launch you. Now, I spoke about that primitive mask. That mask was there to launch an experience. And when the experience had been achieved, the mask was set aside. And yet it was respected as a vehicle of an experience. Because another generation is coming along. But you now are beyond it. All of the divinities in the primitive traditions, in the pagan traditions, in the great oriental traditions, are simply what are called convenient means. They are not regarded as entities solid out there. And this is beginning to come into, even into our official religions now. The realization that God cannot be conceived of. And this is basic. St. Thomas Aquinas in the Summa Contra Gentile says, "For then only do we know God truly when we know that he is beyond anything that can be said or thought of God." And then he writes the Summa Theologica. But you know what happened at the end? He had a vision while saying Mass. He put his pen and pencil, pen and ink, on the shelf. He said to his sister, "It is straw." He did not finish the Summa. It was finished by others. These cults, these images, are there to help us move toward our own fulfillment. And as soon as they serve as a restricting factor, they must be left behind, but not destroyed because they're helping someone else. Now, this is the ambiguous position that exists, I think, in a sophisticated religious environment. Sure, you don't destroy someone else's toys. They're helping. They're educative toys. He's learning. Have you ever belonged to a political party? You got to think the way it's going or form your own party. This is a very interesting thing. In the Western world, starting in the Near East, where the first great societies developed, the political organizations have succeeded in achieving a degree of control that they have never achieved, either in India or in the Far East. And certain religions became official. Now, all you have to do is read the book of Ezra to know what happened in Judaism. Just read that. About 378 BC, Ezra comes to the restored Jerusalem. He finds that the people of God have been marrying Gentiles. And he stands them all up there. It's a very vivid scene, and it's wonderfully told. But you have to use your imagination and just imagine what it was. It was raining. The whole crowd were in the street, in the square, and he started lecturing them. He tore his garment and all. God has been insulted. The holy race has contaminated us. Put your Gentile wives aside. Put your Gentile children aside. And they said, "But it's raining, let's have a meeting." It's a wonderful scene. But he had the authority for this from Artaxerxes, the Persian monarch, who was arranging the different peoples of the empire in terms of their religious community, so that there was an official community stamp put on this. Then consider the Christian tradition. When Constantine, 327, becomes monarch, and raises the Christian religion to the level of other religions. And then, following that, Theodosius issues the Theodosian Code, which makes all other religions unallowed. They were not allowed. You have a religion that is supporting a political institution. That is to say, the religion has been applied primarily to the third of those functions, the support of a social order. And that is what has happened in the West. This is something extremely interesting. It's a historical problem, and it's one that's now running into the ground because those historical controls are gone. Where they do get into control again, you see the whole thing. Look at the state of Israel. Look at Spain. Look at Ireland, where the religious tradition is in the political tradition again, the political control again, and this thing happens. You can't even publish a certain book. Now, if one wants to compare in a broad way Hinduism with, let's say, the Christian tradition, I have a very close friend who I've known for many, many years, a young American, not young anymore, who became a Hindu monk after years of acolyte service, so on. He was a good monk and he knew what he was doing. And then he had a conversion to Christianity, this very interesting thing, to Catholicism. And so he knows more about Hinduism than he does about Catholicism, but he's a good practicing Catholic now, or he's trying to be anyhow. And he's been writing for some of the Catholic journals concerning the missions in India and the relationship of Catholicism to Hinduism. And he said something that struck home for me and is, I think, valid. If you can imagine what Christianity would have been had the heresies, Gnosticism, Pelagianism, Donatism, Arianism, and so forth, not been suppressed, let's say a whole jungle and forests of Christianities, all of them Christian, you'd have the equivalent of Hinduism, which is a jungle of religions. Each sect is Hindu, all right. There are certain common grounds, but there's a great jungle of beliefs in conflict, in argument, and so forth. But none can win, because there's no political power to say, we kill everybody who doesn't believe this. This is the answer, it seems to me, and what I see happening now is a loosening up this, what I might call, social function, stressing more the psychological function, which of course has to be various. There are different people with different emphases in their own character. Some great up here, others in the heart, others with sensation. And the different approaches to religion have to receive them and carry them on. And this is, I'm very optimistic about Christianity if it could only stop being Christian. It's all there. It's just astounding what marvelous possibilities and even past realities there are in relation to this glorious context. It's one of the most vivid symbol systems. And what is now the difference, to give a positive thing, between this and the Oriental? It's this stress on the self-responsibility. In the Oriental systems, there's the erasure of ego, the erasure of ego, the erasure of ego, and the acquiescence in the impersonality. But here, with this wonderful Greek background, where the mentality and the individual thinking is the highest thing, and then come to our European concept of relativity of the different ways, this is a point that you won't find with this stress. And of course, when you look then at Judaism, you can see that the personality principle is there too, because God is a personality. That's it. The personality factor is the thing that has been brought into accent in contrast to the Oriental. The deities in the Orient are not creators. They never had a will to create. The world is impersonally there, and they are the agents of creation. Just as in Ovid's Metamorphoses, the world comes into being, and with it come the gods, who are the agents of this impersonal. We come in touch with the Father through Jesus, who is one with the Father. Now, that term within, this is an extremely problematical, I think you will bear me out here. Jesus could not have said that to a Hebrew group, because God is not within anybody there. God is transcendent. The word can be translated among. And that is the Hebrew tradition. The idea of the minyan, where there are 10 together, we are Any translation that will tell you what all the possibilities of translation are will point this out. Also, there's another strange thing here. The Hebrew, Aramaic, which is what Christ was talking about, but we get it in Greek. These two languages are not the same language, and they can't be translated one into the other. But there is in the Semitic languages a is, to be, which is potential. So that this could easily be translated, and it fits the possibilities of the historical circumstance as meaning the kingdom of God is about to be among you, which fits entirely the apocalyptic attitude of Christ's teaching. It's about to take place. The end of the world is coming. Before this generation passes, this will come to pass. There is the apocalyptic movement out of which Christianity came, which involves this idea that the world is about to end and the kingdom is about to be among us. And that is what that can mean. So what Christ meant, you have your own choice. Do you see what I mean? Now, it's certain that in Christian mysticism, for instance, such a mystic as Eckhart, that's the way it's read. Also, we have the very interesting thing of St. Paul. This is a fantastic man. He's on this side and that side when you read him, because he actually was between the two worlds of the Hebrew and the Greek or Roman tradition. And when he says, I live now, not I, but Christ in me, that's the beginning of what would be the Oriental view. How far does he push it? This is St. Paul's language is the language of the Greek mystery cults, up and down, right along the line. It can be translated into very easily into the classical mystery cult tradition, which is to bring the God principle to life within yourself. That's, I think, what most of us secretly understand by Christ's teaching. Now, whether he meant it or not is another question. We awfully, I think, impudent for anyone to say they knew what Christ said, because it comes through these channels. And we are now finding Gnostic texts just as old as the four Gospels, which presented Christ saying quite different things. The Thomas Gospel, which has been published, is Hopper publishes it, published it, in a beautiful translation, tiny little thing, the Gospel according to Thomas. There is where Christ says, and now this is sheer Hinduism, split the stick and I am there. There was a very strong Gnostic tradition, particularly in the 3rd century, because these things had not come to pass. The normal way of thinking was the world's going to end. This apocalyptic, and it hadn't ended 200 years later. And it's at that time that the Gnostic tradition comes in. And what is the Gnostic tradition? It is the translation of the historical into the symbolic. That's to say, when we say the world is about to end, that does not mean that there's going to take place a physical calamity. That means that the world as you know it, as you are related to it, is about to end in you because you are about to change. You see what I mean? You're translating a historical end into a psychological end. The end of the world takes place every time you have a new experience, a really effective one. This is the great problem in all symbolic contexts. The sophisticated reading is symbolic. The unsophisticated is material, historical, the Garden of Eden. Where was it? You know, people were looking for that. One of the most charming quests was Christopher Columbus. You know, when he sailed, you all know the little picture of the universe as Dante had it, is the globe of the earth, and the mountain of purgatory was in the southern hemisphere. All the water, the mountain of purgatory, and on the top of the mountain of purgatory is paradise. Remember Dante's. And from paradise, of course, as you read in the 1st chapter, there flow the 4 rivers of paradise. Now, these must be very rich rivers. So when Columbus sailed further south than had been sailed before, and sailed between Trinidad and the coast of South America, he found so much fresh water in the salt water coming from the River Orinoco, which is bigger than any river Europe ever thought of, that he thought this was one of the rivers of paradise and that he was on in the suburbs of paradise. And he writes this in his journal. And furthermore, all the natives there, pearls were all over the place. Wouldn't it be so? Well, then for a long while, they thought, well, perhaps it might be up the North Pole. There was that theory for a while, and then when different people went up over the North Pole, it's not there either. So finally, they had to realize that this was not a tangible image. You couldn't find it anywhere. So now let's turn it back into a symbol again, and then what is it a symbol of? And that's where my science, comparative mythology, begins. What do these symbols mean? Paradise symbol is a very important one. Let me say a word, perhaps this will be the end, about paradise. The image of paradise is what Carl Jung calls a mandala. It's a perfect one, with the tree of life in the center, and the rivers going in the four directions, and the wall. The word paradise is from the Persian word meaning walled garden. And Adam and Eve eat the fruit of the tree of knowledge. This is beginning of the awakening of consciousness, bringing them out of the spontaneity of the animal into the world of human consciousness. And then just beyond that would be the tree of immortal life. Remember, there are two trees in the garden. And God says, now, lest they eat that tree and be as one of us, get them out of here. So he drives the bear out. And the serpent, that wonderful, what we say, guardian of the tree of life, who in all other mythologies is the lord of the reincarnating principle. He sloughs his skin and comes to life again. He represents that spirit principle moving through incarnations. He's cursed. Adam and Eve are outside. And a cherub with a flaming sword is placed at the gate. Now, during the Second World War, I think it was the New York Times, which has been guilty of stupidities before, published a picture of one of the temple guardians at the great Japanese temple of the Daibutsu, the great Buddha, at Nara. Those temple guardians you've seen, they have lifted swords and they're standing in a furious attitude and they're guarding the sanctuary. They're at the gate. There are two of them there. Just as there are two lions guarding the New York Public Library. So that only eligible people go through. These are mild pair, but these are the... At any rate, every temple has these temple guardians, and they're in a horrendous attitude. New York Times published a picture of one of these temple guardians, and it says, the Japanese worship gods like this. Well, they don't. What do you find when you go past those guardians? They are in the position guarding the garden. You've come to the great Daibutsu temple, where this glorious image of the Buddha, 56 feet high, seated with his hands in meditation, and the lotus paradise all around him, and the tree of the garden, the tree of illumination, the tree of immortal life right there. Suddenly it dawned on me, this was a moment in my life, that's Yahweh. He's keeping you from the garden. That's the God we worship. What? The goal is to go past him. Well, did anybody ever go past him? And then we come to the role of the Savior, Jesus. He did. Because the cross is that tree, according to the medieval tradition. Christ on the cross has taken us past the temple guardian of the cherub to illumination. But now what's the difference between our reading of the cross and the Buddhist reading of that tree? Well, as you probably know, the Christian tradition has had an awful time interpreting Christ's crucifixion. Why did Christ have to be crucified? I won't go through the list of interpretations, but they're fantastic. The normal answer, in a rather slack way, is atonement. He atoned us with the Father. We disobeyed there. We are atoned with the Father here. Disobedience and atonement. This is what I would call a pedagogical attitude toward the symbol. Man is a child who has disobeyed a parent and has to be atoned. What is the Buddhist idea? The Buddhist idea is not of atonement. What is it that keeps you out of the garden? It's the limitations of your own consciousness. You don't have to have Yahweh there. Just your own stupidity is plenty. That's what's keeping you out. This business of being a goat. We all think we're goats, so we don't roar. And the breakthrough comes through illumination. And it's not atonement. There's another way of reading atonement. At-one-ment. And those are the two mysticisms that I've been talking about. The same image has been reduced to a kindergarten image in the disobedience and atonement system. All you need is a click, the whole thing opens up the other way. These traditions are waiting to come together. And, well, I'm a bit for it, you might say. This whole business of interpreting what Christ did is a function of this whole business. Now, if we read Christ's teaching in the Gnostic terms, then you get something that's practically Buddhist. If you read Christ's teaching in the ecclesiastical terms, then what he did was to found the church. Well, I think you'd have to ask what the real characteristic of Christ's life was, and it was the characteristic of the breaking of authority. I think there are two or three things that Christ said that are said to have been said by Christ in the Orthodox text, not anything that's dangerous in its interpretation, like the kingdom of God is within you, but when he said, the Sabbath is made for man, not man for the Sabbath, that's point one. That's to say, all of your religious traditions, which in a fixed orthodoxy are imposed, are not valid for the person to whom they do not apply. That's what that means, the Sabbath is made for man, not man for the Sabbath. Another one is, and this is the fundamental Christ teaching, which is different from anything I know anywhere else, love your enemies, not love your neighbor. That's easy. It doesn't say that he isn't your enemy either. It's a very interesting statement. To love your enemy to the depth doesn't mean simply the person that you're about to strike or who's about to strike you, but it's the person whose system of beliefs, whose system of ideals, for everything he lives for is exactly antagonistic to yours. There's a kind of relativism implied here. And I think if you read Christ's doings and sayings in terms of these loosening ups, now I don't know where he got these ideas. I think the Sabbath one, that's easy. That is in the world at that time. These systems were cracking up. They were bumping against each other and all this. But the love your enemy one, I don't know where that is anywhere else. Plus, in Buddhism, you get this too, but not in that incisive way. Christ, in my view, in terms of the big mythological imagery, is what in the Orient is a bodhisattva. He's a perfect bodhisattva. And what he says is the bodhisattva way, the way of giving, the way of non-ego, the way of loving your enemy. And that breaks the taboo system of the orthodoxy. The biblical tradition is an exclusive tradition. And this is just the opposite to exclusivism. Because the real enemy, from the standpoint of a religious person, is the religious enemy, the person who represents totally different ideas. I'll tell you what the hero of the Thousand Faces is. It's the story of man's quest, and it's a correlation of myths and legends from all parts of the world in which this quest is represented. And the stages of the quest are there to be found in most of the traditions. Some of the traditions carry us this far, others go still further. And the pattern of the quest is simply this. the separation of the individual from the authority of his society and environment, his going into solitude, his finding there or in his adventure of a value, and then his attempt to bring it back and communicate it to the society again. That first part of the book, that's about the first two-thirds of it, might be, I think it's a rather, well, I know it's a rather entertaining book because people told me so. And I think it would do more than I could do in a lecture here in enriching the picture and giving you a sense of the different mythologies and how they relate. And I would say that would be a book to read. Now, with respect to the Oriental material, I think Alan Watts' book, The Way of Zen, is a very, very good book. Then for the Occidental material, there's another book of Watts's, and that is Myth and Ritual in Christianity. I wonder if you know that. It's a very, very clear and good book. Now, these are two books from the same man, from his two standpoints. And then with respect to the classical ideal, we can do something.
Professor Campbell takes some time at the beginning of his lecture to acquaint the Wainwright House audience with his theory of the four functions of myth. This particular treatment of the four functions is, for me, a most interesting one. He locates the mystical experience in both the first and the fourth functions of myth. The first function experiences the awe and mystery. The fourth tries to understand it. And he remarks that the second function, the function of presenting the total image of the cosmos, as he puts it, has been surrendered to the professional scientific practices of cosmological inquiry, such as physics and astronomy, which, through difficult technical language, esoteric theories, and complicated research findings, one may temporarily arrest that sense of awe. But Professor Campbell does allow that scientific discoveries may easily invoke the experiences of awe and mystery. He's simply pointing out that it's not the job of the professional sciences to summon awe. Likewise, the third function, the sociological function of maintaining social order, which in antiquity was considered to be a part of the cosmic order, is now a function of social institutions such as governments or the criminal justice system. No longer are we required to live according to one's predetermined, assigned place in the cosmic order, but instead, we may live according to our own desire and aspiration. You'll notice the importance Professor Campbell placed on the fourth function of myth, the psychological function of harmonizing the psyche with the conditions of life. The second and third functions of myth have changed a great deal over time, but the scope of the first function, the experience of awe and mystery, and the fourth function, the harmonizing of the human psyche, a psyche that has changed very little since the emergence of Homo sapiens, by the way, have remained constant. Human psychology has changed very little over the eons. In fact, the same mind that invented the atlatl invented 3D printing and gene editing. Human beings have psychological needs and characteristics that have always been and always will be present. Professor Campbell spends some time discussing the rather dependent nature of human animals, the long period of dependence, and then suddenly one is expected to be independent and self-responsible. The rituals of initiation used to facilitate that transition, but in Western societies, those rites are often ignored. Rituals, especially the initiation rituals, reveal to the initiate that the structure, the rules, the forces that shape a society are not literally true. The images and representations of social structures are essentially a masquerade. But the mask shouldn't be thrown away because it's not literally true. It should be revered, Campbell says, and through understanding the larger, non-literal truth of the mask, one then integrates and understands the power structure. Professor Campbell says that the paradox of this type of belief, the belief that a concept, in this case a mask, is true and yet not true all at the same time, is much like the idea of Santa Claus. Children believe that Santa pilots a sleigh pulled by flying reindeer, comes down the chimney, and leaves presents. And at the same time, they know that their parents are responsible for the toys under the Christmas tree. How can children, or anyone really, maintain this kind of double vision? Well, Paul Vane has this to say about it in his marvelous book, Did the Greeks Really Believe Their Myths? And I'm quoting now from that book. A world cannot be inherently fictional. It can be fictional only according to whether one believes in it or not. The difference between fiction and reality is not objective and does not pertain to the thing itself. It resides in us, according to whether or not we subjectively see in it a fiction. The object is never unbelievable in itself, and its distance from the reality cannot shock us. For as truths are always analogical, we do not even see it. Speaking of various truths being analogies, we might compare such reasoning to time. One cannot perceive the limits of time or the depths of centuries stretching beyond our present time any more than one can perceive the limiting line of vision as we gaze out upon the world. At some point, one simply stops seeing. The figures of myth are found on the other side of the horizon in another world, the mythical world, or one might even say, the mystical world. This mythical world was accepted as true in that it wasn't doubted, but it wasn't accepted in the way that everyday reality is. In the Greek world, this mythical world was accepted as true in that it wasn't doubted, but it wasn't accepted in the way that everyday reality is. The world of mystical experience is offered to us as a realm as real and as true as our own. And it is, in relationship to itself, if you will. The sphere of truth may have shifted, but we still occupy the true, or its analogy. This is why realism in literature is at once untrue, as it is not reality, and yet, as long as we're immersed in it through reading and thought, it is true. And if that is not fascinating enough, it requires the most extreme degree of sophistication to create something real with something that is already real. Far from being a lie, fiction is a byproduct of the truth. All we need to do to experience the reality of what I'm suggesting is to lose ourselves in reading a myth or a novel, and we immediately recognize that fiction is not opposed to truth. The only subtlety is that later on, we do not continue to believe it's real. But there are societies where, once the book is closed, the reader goes on believing. This happens with myth, too. This is, I think, also what happens in a mystical experience. C.G. Jung points out that human consciousness is not prepared or equipped to experience the totality of all that is. In fact, consciousness is bound to misunderstand the totality and therefore not tolerate it, because it perceives the totality only in projected form outside itself and cannot integrate it. Consciousness, Jung says, and I'm quoting here from his book, Flying Saucers, A Modern Myth, commits the same grave mistake as the insane person. It understands the event as a concrete external happening and not as a subjective symbolic process. It is not only the insane person who makes this fundamental mistake, but all those who take philosophical or theosophical speculations for objective realities and consider the mere fact that they believe in angels as a guarantee that such things exist in reality, unquote. Professor Campbell takes some time a bit later in the lecture to discuss the differences in the orientation to the divine in both Eastern and Western cultures. He discusses the fact that in Eastern traditions, the concept of the divine as a being, even a supernatural being, is, he says, contrary to the entire tradition, because within that tradition, that sacred reality can't be captured in concepts, images, or language. It is beyond names and forms and apparitions. And the purpose of the religions and cosmic images of a society is to give one an experience that Campbell refers to as the mysticism of identity. To have an experience on the level of the self such that you can't even think of yourself. It's an experience which transcends ego and self-concept. It's an experience beyond thought. It's ineffable. The ego is not us, and yet it is us, but only partially and only superficially. In Jungian terms, the ego is merely the center of the field of consciousness and gives us a sense of being, a sense of personhood, of identity. The ego organizes one's thoughts. It lends to us a sense of continuity and deals with the feelings and sensations of navigating material reality. It has very little to do with the unconscious. But over time, the ego assumes for itself a great deal of control and authority. The ego can believe itself to be not merely the center of consciousness, but the center of everything, and it leaves no room for experiencing. Professor Campbell mentions this tendency of humans, as he put it, to name, conceptualize, and classify. This is the activity of the ego, which is deeply troubled by ambiguity, by uncertainty, and the inability to predict the outcome of future events. Zen, he says, cancels the ego, and what's left once the ego is neutralized is simply experience. Professor Campbell remarks that, quote, "The mind is trained in its critical aspect of thought and evaluation, and we miss the lyrical act of experience." Unquote. This phrase, the lyrical act of experience, is quite lovely, I think, and it reminds me of the poet Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who passed away in February of this year, who was, along with Allen Ginsberg and other beats, a Zen practitioner. In the New York Times last word feature of his obituary, he tells us that his early life was unhappy, and he goes on to say, quote, "So I escaped by lyricism. When present-day life gets too awful, there's the lyric escape," unquote. Ferlinghetti follows up with a few examples of the lyric escape, such as writing a poem, going outside looking at the moon, or even, he says, shacking up with your best girlfriend. But what I hear resounding in his words is that the lyric escape is a flight into beauty, the beauty of pure, unmediated experience. Finishing the discussion of the ego, Professor Campbell turns to the West, noting that all Western religions come from the Levant, that region which includes much of what we refer to as the Middle East, as well as most of Turkey and the Eastern Mediterranean extending to Eastern Libya. In these Western mythologies, a god creates the world, and the world and the creator are not the same, which creates an entirely different psychology and theology. In such a conceptualization, there now must be a relationship between God and man, his creation, and total loyalty must be given to God. This relationship between God and man is the only thing that matters. It's the summum bonum, the highest good, and to say otherwise would be considered heretical. In pagan Europe, it's another matter. The Greeks, Romans, Germans, Celts all believed that humankind deserved one's loyalty. For the Greek especially, the greatest faculty in nature is the human mind and the human spirit. As a way of comparing, Professor Campbell refers to the Old Testament book of Job, saying that God treats Job outrageously. Job protests that he's been loyal to God, and at that protestation, God reveals himself out of a whirlwind and proceeds to give Job a divine lambasting. Ultimately, Job has to recant his human protest and confesses, "I am ashamed." Professor Campbell says a Greek Job would not have groveled. Prometheus, for instance, inveighed against Zeus even as he was being tortured by him. C.G. Jung carried on the European protest in his book, Answer to Job, in which he writes that God himself was immoral, or at least amoral, in his treatment of Job, and has an evil side to his character. From the story of Job, one can see how alienating the monotheistic tradition that demands loyalty to God can be to a people of a more humanistic cast of mind. Professor Campbell goes on to discuss some of the problems of mysticism. And the first problem mysticism encounters is that of authority, the authority of the religious institution, the institution that wants to mandate the entire religious experience. In reality, the institutional authorities merely launch the whole spiritual inquiry. The images and narratives they give us are not to be taken literally, and they are there to help us, Campbell says, move toward our own fulfillment. Here he cautions against the destruction of the images, saying that they should be set aside after one has utilized them, after one has seen through them and discovered their metaphorical truths, but they should not be destroyed. The reason being that those images can and will launch others on their own spiritual journeys. Professor Campbell remarks, near the end of the lecture, that there is a whole forest of Christianities, a great jungle of beliefs held by those who identify as Christian, and he looks a little bit deeper into one of them, namely Gnosticism. In it, Campbell sees a loosening up of the social function of religion and sees it moving more toward the individual's psychological function, as he makes a joke, saying, "I'm very optimistic about Christianity if it could only stop being Christian." And what he means by that is that in sects like the Gnostics, there is a move toward a more Asian type of self-responsibility and a curtailment of the ego. One may see a kind of pantheism operating in a Gnostic text, such as the Gospel of Thomas, wherein Christ is quoted as saying, "I am the all. Cleave a piece of wood, and I am there. Lift up a stone, and you will find me there." Professor Campbell remarks that this statement is extraordinarily similar to Hinduism. Gnostic thought, like the Asian traditions, translates the historic into the symbolic. And this is such an important understanding. It is the transition from a literal, historical reading of the texts to a metaphorical, symbolic reading that places ultimate value on individual experience. It moves the myth from the third function of providing the basis for social order to the fourth function and its primary value of harmonizing one's psychology with the mystical mysteries of human existence. Thank you for listening. I'm Brad Olson, and I'll be back next month with another Joseph Campbell lecture on Pathways with Joseph Campbell.
Pathways with Joseph Campbell is a production of the Joseph Campbell Foundation and the Mythmaker Podcast Network, and is produced by John Booker and Elias Mirnoff. Executive producer Robert Walter. Your host has been Bradley Olson. Editing and audio services provided by Seth Balin. Music exclusively provided by APM Music. For more podcasts and information about Joseph Campbell, please visit jcf.org.